All right, today we've got a really special guest, Cody Royal. First off, Cody's a dad to three kids and a husband. On top of that, he's a coach originally from Australia. He coaches Aussie Rules football, which is Australia's most popular sport for all our American listeners. Now he coaches Aussie Rules in Canada, and he's also the author of two fantastic books, Where Others Won't, and more recently, The Tough Stuff. We're going to be discussing the tough stuff today and in next week's episode. It's really one of the most grittiest and real books on coaching I've ever read. Lastly, I'd like to mention that Cody does similar work with coaches as Nate and I. So he is a real kindred spirit in that sense. He's a mentor and coach for coaches. He's been in the trenches and now he's helping others that are in the trenches. And that's what we are about on the Coaching Culture Podcast. So welcome. I'm JP Nurman, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Nate Sanderson. This podcast is about the real stuff, the tough stuff in coaching and leadership, as well as the practical stuff you need to know to build your team's culture and be the best leader you can be. If you want to get to the notes to this and every episode, be sure to subscribe to our weekly newsletter at tocculture.com. There's also a link in the details of this episode. Enough from me. Let's get into part one of our conversation.
Well, Cody, we appreciate you coming on the podcast here with us, and I want to get started. Obviously, your book for coaches is called The Tough Stuff, and you know, when coaches ask me, what are books that I should be reading, this has cracked the top five for me. I think it's one of the most important books that's been written for head coaches that I've come across in leadership, in culture, in basketball. I think it should be mandatory for everybody that gets a head coaching job. But I'm curious, because the book is so unique, in that it isn't really about leading others, although there's leadership principles in it. It's not directly about culture, although everything that you talk about is related to culture. Why did you write a book about coaches and the seven hard truths of being a head coach?
Well, firstly, Nate, thank you for the kind words. It's great to hear, especially from someone who is a head coach, as that's who I was obviously writing for, and myself as a head coach as well. Really, the foundational moment of writing the book was the personal struggles that I went through as a coach. I had a player take his own life, and when looking for some help, either in book form or mentor form or on the internet, you know, punch it into Google, and frankly, there was nothing. And so about a month after that, COVID hit, and obviously coaching was thrown into turmoil on its own, because, you know, a lot of coaches were, they had time off and they were trying to look after people, but also job security was a thing. And, you know, we were talking about half the professional leagues folding, like they were going to run out of money in those early days, right? And so there was a lot of identity crises going on. And so a mixture of my own experience and then, you know, the pandemic happening and throwing a lot of coaches into the same mentality. They were kind of the foundational pieces behind the book. And yeah, I did certainly spot a gap there, in that there doesn't seem to be a lot written from just the coach's perspective and tell people what they actually go through.
So I want to have you unpack that a little bit more, just for our listeners that maybe haven't read the book or haven't been exposed to some of your work. When you talk about that feeling or that thing that coaches were experiencing, whether it's during the pandemic or you have a personal tragedy with a player, or some of the things that, you know, when you talk about your hard truths of, number one, everyone thinks you're an idiot. You know, when you are describing what that feels like or what you were trying to address, I mean, how do you put that in a capsule and say, okay, here's really the problem, I think, that coaches really need some attention?
Yeah, well, I wanted to capture the lived experience of coaching. So not the grandeur of it all, and not the great stories at the end when, you know, there's the autobiographical moments that, you know, everyone wants to hear about Phil Jackson and winning trophies and all that kind of thing. But very rarely do we hear about the actual lived experience. And what the lived experience is everyone thinks you're an idiot. And it's, you know, your own personal trauma that you bring into the facility. and it's identity issues, and it's you know, thinking, I call it, you have the God particle, right? Like thinking that you have what creates all culture, all coaching, all team success, when in reality it's actually bringing people together. And so when I started to kind of step through, you know, one by one, what the experiences were, they have inherent lessons in them, in that, you know, coaches tend to struggle with many of the same things. And so what I was trying to do was put, you know, kind of catchy names around them that would really grab people, like everyone thinks you're an idiot, because unfortunately that seems to be one of the truths that we all experience.
Definitely how I've felt before as a coach. And so I definitely resonated with the book as well. There's something that jumps out at me early on in the book. You say the toughest pill to swallow may be that the problem is us. We must look in the mirror and begin to make the necessary changes for ourselves. When a coach reads that, that might trigger a defensive response in some. But for me, I start to reflect and think, you know, what does Cody think really are the necessary changes that most coaches need to make? You know, because you're, as a consultant in the sports world, and a coach that's been through this, a coach that's had to go through your own changes, you know, from your experience, what are those important changes coaches need to make?
Yeah, well, an easy one is really off the back of that I find is, you know, we talk about coachability. And what we do with coachability is we say, the athlete should listen to everything that I say, absorb everything that I say, and carry out all of my instructions just because. And we get upset when they don't do that, and we call them uncoachable, and we label them, and we label them uncoachable. Now, none of the responsibility has gone on us as coaches to be a good educator, to understand learning, to not label people necessarily, to and to understand ourselves and our own biases that we bring to our coaching. And so that's really the work that we need to do on ourselves. Is there's two parts of being coachable. There's the coaching and the coaching ability. So right, coachability, if you break the word apart, is coach and ability. So the coach needs ability, but then also the athlete needs to be accountable as well. And so it's a co-creation. And so, you know, that's one that really strikes me as being big in the coaching world, is we think the athlete should remember everything and carry out our instructions, even if they're quite ordinary instructions, and it puts no responsibility on us. And so our accountability is to be, is to look at ourselves first in that instance, and make sure that what we're bringing to the table is actually coaching, and it is actually education, and it is actually more balanced.
Well, I love that, Cody, because I think that's a very relevant, you know, to this idea around emotional intelligence, which is a big thing people talk a lot about in sports today. And I think coaches love to complain about the lack of emotional intelligence or emotional control of athletes. And that's something I know you talk about in the book. And the reality is, for us to be able to help develop emotional intelligence in athletes, we have to develop it ourselves. And in the book, I remember there's a line in there, how can we expect head coaches to develop emotional intelligence and self-awareness in others when they aren't even equipped to recognize or navigate their own emotions? And I'm just kind of curious, before we kind of jump into some of these seven hard truths, you do a lot of coaching of coaches. You know, that's actually how it's described on your website. And I love that, you know, because it's funny, because it's coming back to that coachability. Are we as coaches coachable? You know, so often we're not. But, you know, how do you coach coaches on that to start to navigate our own emotions and recognize those and work through those?
Yeah, so first of all, I didn't really expect to be coaching coaches. It actually happened off the back of the tough stuff. And I was still coaching my team, which is the national AFL program in Canada, the men's team, and was quite happy doing that. I'd been there for a decade. You know, it was my team, my culture, my everything. I was sitting on the golden ticket in terms of coaching. And yeah, opportunities started to arise once more and more coaches read the tough stuff to really mentor or coach other coaches. And so, you know, the interesting thing that I found with doing that, and the reason that I do call it coaching coaches, is because I use the same principles that I use with my players. And so my responsibility is to guide their awareness, to speak to them about their communication, and, you know, talk to them about their decision making. It's really the three primary coaching skills, right? And so how you do that, particularly around emotional intelligence, is really guide their awareness. And so, you know, one example would be, because we're talking about emotion, one of the things that I quite dislike, because I think there's no real thought gone into it, is the angry coach stalking the sideline. So you guys are from basketballs. So it happens countless times every game. Soccer is another one where they're just running up and down the sideline like madmen, yelling instructions, trying to puppeteer the game, yelling at the fourth official or the referee, or yelling at their players. And what it takes is, when you guide their awareness and ask questions like, do you think that helps your team or hinders your team, and show them the vision of them doing it, often they understand that it's hindering the team, or probably hindering the team, but haven't actually put a lot of thought into an alternative. And so then it starts to become, again, you kind of guide them through that process. What would be a better alternative here? And then, you know, again, another question might be, if you're asking your players to be calm and methodical in high-pressure situations, and this is how you respond, and they see you responding this way in high-pressure situations, how do you think they're going to interpret that? And, you know, again, one of the things we know as coaches is we create ourselves in our team. Our teams become us. And so, you know, again, there's not a lot of thought gone into the fact that angrily walking down the sideline, cussing and yelling at the referee, the players start to do that if you're doing it. And so, again, guide a coach's awareness. What do you think would be a more constructive way to harness your energy and your passion? Let's not take that away, but harness it and put it into things that are actually going to help the team. And then, you know, again, we go through a coaching process to see that into fruition. But yeah, ultimately the same kind of process you would use with a player, guiding their awareness through it. You know, how did you communicate this? Could we have done that better? How did you make a decision like that? You know, that kind of thing. But it's directed towards the coaches.
Yeah, I love that process. I think we don't necessarily use these terms, but a challenging question is your behavior as a coach worthy of replication? You know, if that was the standard of behavior in your players, as you said, would that make us a better performing team or not in those pressure moments or not? And sometimes, as you said, there just isn't that awareness and that reflection of how contagious our own emotional state is as a head coach. And I think that that's awesome to bring that, you know, bring that to their attention. I want to ask you about one more phrase here before we jump into the kind of the seven truths that you outline in the book, because as I mentioned to you off air here, we did a cohort this spring, just a small book study about a dozen head coaches. And we took about 4 weeks to just have conversations about some of the content in the book and just applying that to our own situations. And the sentence in the book, I don't care who I send this book to or who I talk to about it, that always comes back. The first thing everybody says is like, I understand that completely, is the weight. You define the weight, what it feels like to carry this burden as a head coach. You write in the book, it's the cumulative stress and anxiety brought upon by caring deeply about people and the impact and influence your role has on them. First of all, kind of how did you come to that definition? And, you know, when you think about the weight and the number of coaches that immediately identify with that, what's the first next step? You know, when we start to recognize this is finally a way to describe what I felt for so long.
Yeah, as I described to you guys earlier, I mean, I went through an experience where I felt the weight. And so I don't actually know the actual process of kind of coming up with the phrasing, but I want to believe that it was going through that and actually feeling the physical response in my body to an emotional experience, and how it was that very stereotypical, felt like I had the weight of the world on my shoulders experience. In what I mean by that is when a player on your team takes his own life, you have, on my team, 40, 50 young men looking at you as a leader to how to grieve and what to do and how to stick together. And that was very confronting for me because there's no manual for that. There's no book for it. It has nothing to do with Aussie rules football. It has nothing to do with coaching, but they're still looking to you. And so that's what I mean, like the weight of caring. It's a complete misunderstanding of the coaching experience to say that it's the weight of expectations, because it's actually not. There is no head coach that I've met anywhere in the world, high school level, college level, pro level, that doesn't have greater expectations of themselves than anything the media can come up with, that anything the fans can come up with. It blows them away. And you guys know this as head coaches yourselves, but also in the community. We have such high standards for ourselves and we want so much, but it's actually the cumulative effect of all of the caring that we have and caring about people and wanting to see them realize their potential and believing in people. And I've heard that a lot, that resonates with people, but it does actually become this physical manifestation of an emotional experience. And so I think what we can do better as a community is talk about it in that sense, because you can actually see coaches when you walk past them. You can see it in their shoulders and you can see it in their jaws and you can see it in their body, right, that they're under some stress. And so if we talk about it in the right way, I think we can identify it better, which means we can also put measures in place to help coaches that are maybe going through some, maybe some additional caring.
I think what's so powerful about that phrase, why so many can relate to it, is because there's the stress and anxiety, right? And it acknowledges, like, if we do this right, deeply care and love the people that we're working with, our coaches and the players. Like, if we're doing this thing the way we should, at least from our kind of transformational perspective here, you should care a lot about the people you're coaching. And yet, I know a lot of the coaches in our cohort, the thing that was so challenging for them is, yet I know that I don't have the resources to make them all happy. I don't have enough playing time, starting, jerseys, whatever it might be. And, it's just so interesting how that seems to be, it's like it's missed by so many people that aren't head coaches. When you think about what's tough, and, we think about pressure and we think about, oh, there's so many job responsibilities, but so many coaches just identify with that idea that I really care about my kids and I know I don't have the ability to give them everything that they want.
Yeah, it's one of the catch-22s of coaching, isn't it? In that, you know that. And yeah, again, I've heard that reiterated multiple times as well, which again suggests that the lived experience that coaches are having is quite different from what people interpret. And so I think we can bring it closer together though by talking about it, and maybe that giving it a name like that, like Brené Brown says in a lot of her books, is naming things can often help, because then you can talk about something tangible. So, yeah, I'm glad to hear that resonated.
Well, Cody, let's dive into the first of your seven hard truths here that you talk a little bit about in the book. And again, anytime I encourage somebody to read this, I say, listen to the title of the first chapter. Everyone thinks you're an idiot, and everybody immediately gives you credibility instantly. So when it comes to, coaches that obviously have to deal with criticism, we know that that's part of the game, right? What are some, just basic, like, strategies or tips that you can give for how do we manage the outside chatter and the criticism of a play call that doesn't go right, or, you know, the high school, we got parents chirping in the stands, you know, without changing the context, muting those parents. How do I start to do some inner work there to help me to be able to handle that fact that there are quite a few people out there that probably think I am an idiot?
I'll give my editor credit for this, because when he saw that written, I don't think it was actually the chapter header initially, but when he saw it, he's like, that has to be the what you open with. But yeah, it's an interesting one, because if you take a step back for a second and just look at the trajectory of coaches, is, you know, even in, I'll use your sport as an example, and you watch these young coaches come through and they're assistants and they're tactical wizards and they're, you know, they're held up on the pedestal, they're talked about, you know, in on ESPN as the next big thing, and they kind of come through and they're heralded. And then almost instantly, by virtue of becoming the head coach, all of a sudden everyone thinks they're an idiot, and every decision that they make, every substitution, every tactical adjustment, every cultural element, people start to question. And so that's a weird dynamic on its own. You can also look to really the unpreparedness for being a head coach that I find fascinating, in that there's kind of nothing really that you can do if you haven't been a head coach before to fully prepare for the top job. And really that's what the chapter is about being in the spotlight, and the fact that, you know, in soccer, you know, Steven Gerrard has talked about this, very famous Liverpool player, and played 500 games and been a captain of every team that he'd ever been on. So then gave presentations to the players, obviously, and spoke to the players. But then day one of coaching, he said, it was the most nervous I've ever been giving my first team talk to Rangers, Glasgow Rangers, where he coached first. And so this is someone who's probably given hundreds of team talks as a captain and watched his coaches closely and all this sort of stuff, but still left unprepared. And so, yeah, again, there's a very weird dynamic going on here, where the trajectory that you've been on and the work that you've done previous to being a head coach still leaves you slightly unprepared for the spotlight. And then you add on media pressure and them digging into your history and questioning your belief system and all these different things on top of that. And so where I go with this one is really around awareness, that you need to develop strategies for this kind of, I call it lack of belief in you. Like, you really need to staunchly understand who you are, what you're trying to create, and then hopefully communicate that at those opportunities that you get where there is questions around whether the tactics are working, whether, you know, you're developing players at the rate they should be, whatever it may be. So I think we can, as coaches, I think going back into our shell at the thought of people thinking we're an idiot is one tactic. I don't think that works. I think we've been trying that. I think we might want to actually come out the other way and start to explain some of this stuff and try to explain what we're doing in a little bit more of a proactive way than we have been in the past. And if you do genuinely believe in what you're doing and the path that you're on at whatever level, that should come through in actually explaining it to people. So rather than leaving people in the dark, why don't we come to the table a little bit and say, no, I've got this. I understand what I'm doing. I understand you can't see it and can't believe it, but here's some of the elements that we're going through. And I believe that this is going to come to fruition for us in the future.
You talk about the importance of, or the our effect as coaches, the effect of our time on others when we spend time with individuals. You know, while we may have this narrative that everyone thinks we're an idiot, and they may do that, but we still have great effect if we were to invest in those relationships and time. And that's obviously something I talk extensively about in my own book recently too, is just that being one of the potentially best uses of our time as well too. And how might that be an answer as well for this kind of narrative of everyone thinks you're an idiot?
Yeah, I was fortunate to speak to Dan Quinn for the book, who, you know, is a great coach and is probably, unfortunately, more famous for the losing Super Bowl than his work with the Falcons over an extended period of time. But that really resonated with me, what he said around, you know, he'd never been a head coach at any level before until he got to the NFL, to talk about learning on the job. He said one of the things that struck me as changing the most was that I had to realize, again, it's a personal thing, he needed to do this work himself. I needed to realize that whilst it might have just been another 10 minutes for me, the person that's come into my office to deliver the bad news or tell me the good news or whatever might be the most important 10 minutes of that person's day. And that happens multiple times a day. And so if you're not present with them and you're not there and you're off thinking about something else or you're grumpy, it has a huge knock-on effect. You know, if you just think about that on its own, that person might have had a sleepless night thinking about having to come into your office the next morning to tell you something. And then when they get in there and they deliver the message, you just dismiss them. If you think about the knock-on effect of that interaction and how now you've just demoralized one of your staff members instantly. They then go home to their partner. They might have another conversation with two other people in the building and be like, coach was a dickhead to me. He doesn't believe in me. He's never nice to me. He didn't even look at me when I was talking to him. Knock on effect outwards, right? There's a whole tree effect to that. And it knocks down and it starts to create a cancerous culture just by one interaction of you not being there. And so that time is important for you as a person. And again, this is one of the reasons I really wanted to present this book from the coach's perspective. It's your lived experience, not their lived experience, that's most important here. You need to be present in that 10-minute conversation with that person and really there for it to have a positive impact on your culture.
I think that's so interesting. And I'm going to kind of relate this to another podcast I was listening to over the weekend about just screen time and children. So this is going to be a strange connection here, but this expert was on and the host was talking about, you know, I've got little kids that are 3-4 years old. They want to be on my phone all the time. They want to watch TV all the time. You know, how do we navigate this? Right. And there's all this narrative about how, you know, phones are bad and, you know, all this. And what she said, I thought was really interesting. She said, it isn't necessarily, at least at that age, about phone addiction or, you know, tricky apps that will get you, you know, sucked in. It's about what the phone keeps the kid from doing. If it keeps the kid from interacting with their parents or playing outside or going and, you know, having a play date with another cohort of their age group, that becomes developmentally problematic because they're missing those opportunities. And when I thought about that and we were preparing for this, I thought in a lot of ways that's kind of similar to, you know, this second piece of your fiercest rival is yourself, that there are times and there are things that we do as coaches that get into our own way that maybe, you know, whether it's that grumpiness or whether it's our tight schedule and we don't have time for people, it's not necessarily an evil in and of itself, except as you just described there, when it keeps us from connecting with people and keeps us from providing moments and being present. And, you know, in that second chapter, you talk about a number of different pitfalls that coaches fall into where we disadvantage ourselves, you know, with a lack of awareness and really skills to be able to handle some of those things. What do you say to coaches that look in the mirror and say, damn, you know, Cody, you're right. I was a jerk to the custodian yesterday. I didn't give this player a very good greeting when I passed him in the hallway. What's the response to that, right? When we start to see, geez, we're creating some obstacles for ourselves here.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I mean, I love that example because that's exactly it. It's actually the missed opportunities. And, you know, in terms of the second part of your question there, you know, working with coaches on their, really, I see this as kind of the outside coaching portion of the book. So it has ramifications on coaching, obviously. But when I'm talking about your fiercest rival is yourself. Really what I'm talking about is you as a human being. So when you strip away the coaching element, there's a lot of things that we bring into the coaching environment that are going to ultimately dictate our success as a leader. And some of those are pitfalls, certainly. But, you know, again, I think these are more socially ingrained in us than from a coaching perspective. And so when I'm working with coaches about some of these things, like just to extrapolate, like we're talking about things like addiction and alcohol and, you know, some pretty heavy things in this chapter, where there's a lot of coaches that can't get to sleep without, you know, a bottle of wine. Now, that's problematic, but that's a social problem as much as it is a coaching problem. And so it certainly impacts our teams a lot, but really what we're talking about is understanding the socialization of alcohol and other stimulants. And I mean, it doesn't need to be alcohol, so it could be shopping, right? Like it's some sort of pain or trauma that's coming out in a particular way. And so really where I go with it is trying to understand the triggers and how that is socialized. So just to continue along the alcohol one, right? Like my sport, Aussie Rules, it's a big part of the game. The socialization and having a beer in the changing rooms after with your team and then the other team. And that very quickly becomes multiple drinks. It very quickly becomes not being able to get to sleep. So I'll you know, go home and have one. It very quickly becomes, you know, there's been pretty high profile examples of coaches losing their jobs. You know, Jim Montgomery in the NHL is a big one, right? Like the Dallas Stars went to the Stanley Cup finals the year that he got fired for his own alcoholism. So he was coaching one of the best teams in the NHL and unfortunately couldn't rein it in and lost his job of a Stanley Cup team that, you know, could have obviously set him and his family up for a lot of future success with contracts and things like that. And so those are personal challenges. And I think we need to understand the, you know, how they're ingrained in our lives to start to undo some of them if coaches want to make changes there.
Love what you're talking about there, because you and I, we do similar work, I think, to help coaches and mentorship and coaching and support on their journey. And I think I get worried, maybe you can relate to this, but I get worried when a coach might come to me initially and they just seem really focused on the culture of their team and improving there. And maybe they want to dive a little bit into leadership, but so much of this journey has to start with ourselves. And I think people hear personal development or self-help and they like cringe and they withdraw, you know, rightfully so. There's some cringeworthy stuff out there in that area.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's just, it's essential. Without this, you know, we're, even when we're successful on the outside, it's just a house of cards ready to come down, isn't it?
Exactly. You know, and again, I've talked about one particular element of that, but I would include another thing that I talk about there is workaholism. Right? And this idea that unless you're in the facility watching film and, you know, work until 3 a.m., you're not setting your team up for success. But again, it's something that, one, is socialized into us. That's what, you know, you guys are from North America, I'm from Australia. We're taught to work hard. And if you work hard, that leads to success, right? And so as coaches, we go, well, I can always put more hours in. But then all of a sudden, you're working 20-hour days, not sleeping, so none of it's sticking anyway, and you can't really call yourself high-performing at that point. And, you know, again, what I found helpful and I would encourage others to think about is our job is to make athletes high-performing. And so we know a lot of the things that in our environment that we can offer to them that can help them perform at a high level. And I think we can listen to our own advice a lot more. So sleep is a huge one. We tell our athletes to go home and sleep. And there's a lot more now available in terms of measuring sleep and understanding sleep. And then we don't sleep. We tell them and get angry at them if they don't eat nutritious food. And then we go through the McDonald's drive-thru, right? Last minute, get a couple of hamburgers before the team meeting. You know, we've talked about alcohol, right? Like there's a lot of performance elements that we are not listening to for ourselves that we know can make us better performers. And that's the most interesting part of it, is if we can get better coaches and our performance can improve, I think we know that the team performance can improve off the back of that.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. Number five, when it comes around to the tough stuff, is you're hired for your brain. And you talk about, you know, sleep. And I think there's so many, like you talked about just this culture, this pressure to go sleepless nights, you know, like, and if I'm not, you know what, I love what you said earlier. You said the expectation of others is never as great as our own expectation. I think this is the same thing here too. Like, I don't think anybody's really sitting outside our office going, oh gosh, there he goes, he's leaving. You know, he left at, you know, 8 o'clock, you know, like it's this owner inner narrative. I know it exists in my own self. You know, I really struggle to work less than 60 hours a week. If I think I'm working 40 hours a week, I'm like, oh man, I'm not working hard enough. Everything's going to fall apart here. You know, my wife isn't saying work 60 hours a week. Nobody else is telling me. Nate's not telling me to work 60 hours a week, but it's always this inner narrative. So my question for you is on this, you know, you talk about sleep being so important. What's it going to take for coaches to change? Like how have you seen in your work with coaches, how have you helped some people actually get over the hump in this? Because it is a battle.
Yeah, a lot goes through the shakes like you just described, where, you know, if you get it right, what it means is there's actually time to do things, and then they don't know what to do with that time. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of that, like weaning yourself off sugar, you know, how it kind of gives you the shakes, which is, and so, yeah, really it's, I think what we're really dealing with is in a sense, an addiction to work. And so when you take that away, I think it becomes a little bit problematic, but it's really about aligning ourselves with our performance elements that we know are helpful. And so, you know, I think one of the things that we can look to in terms of getting coaches over this hump is that the military has gone this way. So we constantly look to the military for human performance ideas and science. Now, the Army have rewritten their guidebook. They now include nap guidance, when to nap, how long to nap for, in the field, like how to take naps, so that they can remain alert, so that they can remain communicative, so that they can make remain decisive, so that they can remain social. So the organizations that we're looking to and copying for all, you know, the height of human performance and decision making are saying, we used to think that sleep was for, you know, soft people. We got that wrong. And now we're going back the other way, and we're now instructing our soldiers out in the field as well as our leaders to go to bed. I think if that's not enough, then I don't know what's going to be. because again, the organizations that are really at the forefront of this, which sport should be, that tends to have a bit of a lag effect, they have already gone. And so they're really seeing the benefits of that. And again, you know, it could just be a 15-minute nap in the afternoon. It doesn't need to be this whole, you know, complete dismantling of your day and the whole thing that's got you to being successful. It doesn't mean work less. It just means work better. It means listen to your own advice around human performance, eat nutritiously, right? Like all the work that you're doing on video and staying up late, unless you get into a state of deep sleep, that doesn't save anyway. And again, we should know this because it's our job. And so it's really aligning ourselves with the performance environment that we're in, more so than, you know, saying stop doing this. It's just a realignment more than anything.
Well, I think in a lot of ways it reflects just what's missing in coaching education. You know, I think back to the classes that are required for an authorization in the state of Iowa. No one is talking about the importance of sleep or the dangers of workaholism or, you know, doing too much for your team. And as you keep saying, like, but that affects our ability, right, and our performance. And so I think there's an alternative track there that we just have to be better. And I think that's kind of what drives JP and I, and I'm sure yourself as well, is the more that we can share that, you know, as successful examples and not just guys that flame out because they slept in their office and got divorced three times and don't know their kids. And I mean, those are cautionary tales for sure. But, you know, it's got to be part of the overall conversation too, I would imagine.
Well, but just look at game day, right? Like, so if you think about if you play at 7 p.m., for instance, and you might get up at 7 a.m., if you think about how much you miss in terms of your awareness and how your communication changes and how long it takes for you to make decisions and be aware of certain things when you're tired, if you just think about game day, what we do is we've had a 12-hour day and then it's game time. Now, your job is to be aware, to make decisions, and to communicate. All those things deplete throughout the day dramatically. And so even if we're just thinking about game day, there is no way humanly possible coaches are at their absolute optimum if they've had a 12-hour day in a stressful environment and then gone into battle. And so there are measures there that are right in front of us, like a nap or like the nutrition or like exercise, that can help us really heighten. And then that's the exciting part, guys, is you know how good you can be when you've got your awareness, when you've got your communication dialed. Like, think about how much more you can notice in games and little tactical adjustments that you're making, opposition are making. You can spot those things when you're on. But unless you're putting yourself into a state where you can be on, then you're not going to see that kind of stuff, or you're going to miss really key elements during the game.
All right, that's it for today. We'll be back more in next week's episode with Cody. In the meantime, be sure to check out his book, The Tough Stuff. It's hard to put down. I think I read it in about 2 days, and I keep coming back to it time and time again.